Peter had sent half a dozen dig teams into the mountain. They used the same vehicles they'd stolen days ago to infiltrate the processing facility, along with a handful they'd located in the facility itself. The engineers had warned him more than once that any tunnels they created would be unstable, prone to collapse if they drilled into the wrong type of rock, let alone if the mountain came under bombardment.
"It'll work,"
Vipra had promised him before he'd left for Pinyumba. "It's not really that difficult. It's what half the tools here are built for."
"You don't want to do it," Namir had said.
Vipra had shrugged. "We built a defense against any Imperial dig team trying to come in like we did. Channel the magma, incinerate the foe. You told us to get ambitious. Now we're getting ambitious. I can make the mountain spill its guts all over the place. But I don't think half the dig teams will survive. I think you're asking them to die, and they'll die pretty horribly. They'll be buried alive, or caught on the flow."
"Will they do it?" Namir had asked.
Vipra had nodded. The decision was made. On the mountain, Namir watched lava seep from the mouths of freshly dug tunnels and trickle into the open. Most of the lava streams emerged below the level of the Imperial army, but that was to be expected. Fire rose where the streams touched scrub grass or corpses. Transport vehicles stationed behind the bulk of the enemy force rapidly turned aside. Soldiers higher on the slope shouted panicked warnings, fled the heat into the blazing weapons of Twilight Company. The lava would encircle the upper reaches of the peak almost entirely. The Imperials would be left with nowhere to fall back to. They would be demoralized, terrified, and they would strike at Twilight Company with renewed fury because of it. It might ultimately prove to be in the Empire's favor. But trapping the enemy army in with Twilight wasn't the lava's only purpose. Additional streams would spring out closer to the mountain's base, and Twilight Company's dig teams weren't the only dig teams operating. Nian Nunba's rebel cell hadn't had much in the way of weaponry or manpower, but it had possessed mining vehicles. Submerging half a dozen Imperial guard stations in lava seemed like a fine way to start a revolution. Mimir hoped the rebel cell truly could rally the people of Pinyumba. He wondered if he'd survive to learn whether that part of the plan worked. Twilight celebration ended as the Imperials redoubled their attack. Stormtroopers vaulted over rocks at the crest, struck Twilight soldiers with the butts of their rifles before being shot down themselves. The press of bodies became too much for the company. Blaster rifles drew too much power, overheated too quickly to stop every enemy who reached the top of the slope. Namir signaled the retreat, and squads abandoned portable artillery and dying comrades to back toward the facility entrance and navigate the company's maze of barricades. It was as orderly as a swift retreat could be. The squads knew a withdrawal was part of the plan, knew who could afford to leave first and who could stay behind to provide cover. They did their duty as white-armored troops tossed grenades and Imperial flame units sprayed death in an effort to force Twilight to scatter. Namir separated from Hober somewhere in the retreat, caught his breath behind an overturned load lifter used to block the cavernous mouth of the facility's eastern entrance. He was toward the back of the maze, and he watched squads filter through and take up stations while others found purchase on the rooftop. He was swapping out his rifle's power pack when a mighty hand clasped his soldier and a voice declared in a deep bellow,
"When nature itself turns against our foes, how can we lose?"
He turned to see Gadrin standing above him and grinning broadly. Roach stood behind the alien, one soldier inexplicably covered by a stormtrooper's pauldron. She was shifting her weight rapidly from one leg to the other, her smile far more slight.
"Let's try not to find out, huh?" Namir asked, and gave Gadrin's side a solid smack.
His eyes, however, were on Roach. Part of him wanted to offer her a chance to run, to hide deep in the facility until the battle was over. But that wasn't what she needed.
and he suspected it wasn't what she wanted.
You'll do good, both of you, he said.
Any word from Pinyamba?
No, Namir said, but we weren't expecting any. We've given them all the support we can. We've melted their jailers and we've trapped the local army up here. If they can't pull off a rebellion now, they've only got themselves to blame.
Gadrin nodded. Roach took one of his arms and tugged gently.
We going?
He asked.
We'll see you after,
Gadrin said to Namir.
Stay safe, my friend.
You too,
Namir said. Roach led Gadrin away into the ranks. Namir watched the two go and worked to steady his suddenly ragged breathing and his trembling hands. Then, as the pair nearly disappeared from sight, Roach glanced back at him. He made himself smile tightly, offer a nod of encouragement. She winked back, and Namir began to laugh.
The squads on the facility roof were tasked with occupying the enemy's portable artillery and heavy weapons teams. So long as those units couldn't engage, the Imperial infantry would be forced to funnel through the mazes into the facility entrances and Twilight's kill zones. Even the total destruction of the facility was no longer an option. Not unless the Empire was prepared to sacrifice its trapped army along with the facility itself. It was mostly stormtroopers who'd survived the climb up the mountain, and it was stormtroopers who began fighting their way inside. Twilight's makeshift barricades didn't last long against a barrage of blaster fire and grenades, but even rubble slowed the enemy down. As Twilight squads lost their cover, they fell back to the rear and let the next row of teams become the defense's vanguard. Namir fired into the storm of blaster bolts until his rifle was drained of all power, switched to his sidearm, and kept shooting until someone tossed him a battery pack. He was lying on the metal-plated walkway leading to the mouth of the facility. He rose to his knees only as long as it took to sight a foe and pull the trigger. It was the sort of battle he'd been fighting since he was a child. It felt as natural as breathing.
Although squads withdrew and soldiers fell, although the stormtroopers kept coming, Twilight did not relinquish the entrance. For every company member who died, a dozen Imperials died in turn. Attrition was taking its toll on the once massive horde that had climbed the mountain. The Twilight squad seemed to instinctively understand their success. Shouts of encouragement and triumph rose up as together, the soldiers realized they might actually win. As Namir withdrew from the burning wreck of the load lifter into the facility's main hallway, he cast one last look toward the sky and the distant battle between the Star Destroyer and a pilotless promise. The ground battle could be won. Namir was proud of that. The aerial battle could not, and Namir had no cards left to play. It was conceivable that the rebels' cell would take the city's defensive cannons. But even that scenario almost certainly wouldn't occur in time to save Twilight. The residents of Pinyamba had more pressing concerns, and by the time they could turn weapons on the Star Destroyer, it would be much too late. As soon as the promise was destroyed, the Star Destroyer would return its attention to the processing facility. It would see that the Imperial Army had failed. It would realize that sparing the facility was no longer possible under any circumstances. Unless a miracle transpired, it would obliterate the entire mountain peak. Yet Namir had done his best. He'd given the spirit of Twilight Company its due. He would die with a grin and a battle cry.
Chapter 38. Planet Samast, Day 3 of the Siege of Inusutor.
It had been too long since Captain Tabor Saitaron had last tasted victory. He'd forgotten the exhilaration of a proper battle, the joy of calling orders and encouragement to a proud and dedicated crew, the tense thrill of suddenly fathoming an opponent's gambit. The arrival of the rebels' gunship had amused him,
He'd foreseen it as a possibility, albeit an unlikely one, but the weaponization of Inusutor's lava had come as a genuine surprise. Governor Chalice and her allies were cleverer than he'd expected. Not that the outcome was in doubt. He watched the gray sky through the viewport of the Herald's Bridge, saw X-wings flash by in clouds of sparks and smoke. The Star Destroyer wasn't built for atmospheric maneuvering, but neither were the enemy ships, and they lacked the firepower to be more than an irritant. As soon as the gunship and its starfighters were gone, the Herald would deliver a fresh infantry battalion to reinforce the bleeding and battered army trapped on the peak and the forces suffocating brushfire rebellions in Penumbra. The siege would be broken, the Celestine governor's precious mineral processing facility would be saved, and Prelate Verge would recover the object of his quest. Verge himself seemed an admixture of nervous and eager energies. Where Tabor stood at the center of the bridge, Verge paced above the control pits, calling commands to the gunners. Tabor did not interfere. The voice orders were unnecessary, but sensible enough, and Tabor had seen worse battlefield commanders.
Prelate, sir! Captain Cyteron!
Tabor turned to the communications officer expectantly. Barsel, Tabor thought. Competent lad, overeager, but young enough to have an excuse. Verge cast a backward glance in the man's direction, waved permission to speak.
There's a shuttle leaving off from one of the transport stations, Barsel said.
Escaping the lava, I presume,
Tabor said.
Is it broadcasting clearance codes?
Yes, sir,
Barsel said.
The ones you said to watch for.
Tabor chuckled and caught an approving smile from Verge.
Let this be a lesson to all of you, Tabor called. You may trick a wise man once, a fool twice, but no one falls for the same treachery three times.
Governor Chalice had used her security codes to approach an Imperial transport in the Redhern system. The rebels had used them again to bypass the blockade of Hoth. For her to try a third time, to flee her own battle in a shuttle, seemed an extraordinary act of hubris.
Bring the shuttle in with a tractor beam, Verge said, before it leaves the atmosphere. Keep it intact, please. We'll meet it in the shuttle bay.
Verge was striding toward the turbo lift before he had finished the sentence, yet he pivoted when Tabor didn't follow. After a moment, Tabor grimaced and left the viewport for the prelate's side. He kept his voice low as he spoke.
You don't need me for this. One of us should remain here.
He feared he might anger the prelate, but the boy only shook his head and squeezed Tabor's shoulder.
Do you truly think we're needed for this battle? Our real triumph is in the hangar. I want you at my side.
It was almost a plea, like a child might make to his father. Tabor wanted to refuse, to state sternly that so long as men were dying under his watch, he could not walk away. Every victory had a price, and though the Herald was unassailable, casualties were mounting below. To bear witness was a matter of respect. Yet he knew Verge well enough to guess what the boy would think of respecting one's underlings above all else.
I have my link, Tabor called to the control pits. The moment anything changes, inform me immediately.
The enemy at last,
Verge murmured as they boarded the lift.
Do you suppose she knows the end has come? Will she acknowledge that her own disloyalty inevitably led to failure?
She's a bottom-feeding rat, Prelate, Tabor said. I wouldn't expect gravitas from this confrontation.
Then we will bring meaning to it,
Verge said.
In the Emperor's name.
The tractor beam delivered the shuttle to the tertiary hangar bay. Scanner showed only a single life form aboard. If Chalice was the passenger, as Verge so clearly believed, she'd come alone. To Verge's amusement, Tabor chose two fleet troopers for security. Zios and Cantompa, both men whom Tabor had come to appreciate during his time aboard the Herald.
They'd watched Verge torment their peers, attended to Bor when he'd taken sick from the change in his diet, stood outside the tactical center in their crisp black uniforms and helmets for hours on end. Tabor trusted them. And if there was any honor to be gained in Chalice's final capture, they deserved to share it.
"Do you expect to storm out rifle blazing?" Verge asked as Tabor's escort preceded them through the Durasteel door into the shuttle bay.
At least, Tabor thought, the prelate wasn't openly snickering.
"I expect a bit of caution does no harm," Tabor said.
One of the men called an all clear, and Verge led Tabor into the hangar, the same one, Tabor recalled, where he had first disembarked aboard the Herald. The shuttle inside had already lowered its boarding ramp. The guards had their rifles aimed at the entrance. With slow, almost ceremonial deliberation, the shuttle's passenger descended. She wore the black uniform of an Imperial Army captain, though her boots were non-standard. A breath mask hung unused around her neck. Her arms were spread wide, her palms up, in a gesture that might have indicated either surrender or welcome. Her features broadly matched Tabor's memories, but she appeared haggard and thin, exhausted despite the cruel smile that played across her lips.
"Forgive the outfit," Governor Chayla said. "I borrowed it from one of your men to access the shuttle."
She turned her hips slightly, and Tabor saw the fabric was frayed and burned in one spot on her torso, the mark of a blaster bolt. He stiffened and scowled.
"To murder a man and then make light of it?"
"Not one of my men," Verge said. "One of the Emperor's nonetheless. Another treason for your tally."
But Chalas turned to Tabor first, eyes widening in exaggerated surprise.
"Captain Citeron," she said, "you came out of retirement for me. Your mistress must be jealous."
He'd forgotten about her accent, that awful, exaggerated schoolgirl Coruscanti, as if she might fool anyone into thinking she hadn't been born in the bowels of a colonial backwater. Count Vidian had been a clever man, but Tabor couldn't imagine why he'd gone to such trouble to uplift Chalice.
"I hoped to keep my mind sharp," he began.
"And you must be the prelate."
Chalice cut Tabor off and turned to Verge, looking the stern-faced boy up and down.
"But you hardly gave me the opportunity," he'd intended to finish.
He bristled at the interruption, forced his irritation down.
"Truly," Chalice continued, "you must be an extraordinary individual. To have been granted a new title by Palpatine himself, not made a moff or minister or vizier with all those duties and responsibilities, but a prelate."
Tabor couldn't tell whether Verge understood he was being mocked. The boy eyed Chalice with disdain, looked at her as if her very existence were a personal affront.
"So far as you are concerned," Verge said, "I am the agent of our Emperor in this place. You have not done well by our Lord and Master."
Chalice laughed, a sound that might have been light and joyful if it weren't for a guttural hoarseness behind it.
"You're very keen on styling yourself the Emperor's favored servant, aren't you? Is it true that you built a shrine to him on Naboo? That you like to shock yourself late at night to see if you can endure what he endured to earn his scars? Maybe if you wore a mask, he'd treat you more like he does Vader."
Verge took a single step forward, and Tabor saw his body trembling. The thought of what Verge might do to Chalice didn't concern him. Was she looking to bait him into giving her a swift death? But if Verge's anger grew too great, if he lashed out at others...
"You needn't listen to this prelate," Tabor said.
Verge didn't appear to hear him.
"I apologize," Chalice said and half-bowed. "I congratulate you on your defeat of me. I've come to make you an offer."
"An offer?"
Verge said. It was nearly a whisper.
I've learned more than any spy about the inner workings of the Rebel Alliance. Its leadership, its plans, its vulnerabilities. Chalice's voice had suddenly lost its playfulness and dropped an octave. Grant me a pardon for my crimes, and I'll share it all with you. Verge's trembling increased. His lips half parted as he drew long, hissing breaths. Tabor found that his own jaw was sore and clenched. He glanced to his guards to see if they too feared what their prelate might do. Although both aimed their weapons at Chalice, their eyes were on Verge. All at once, Verge's trembling stilled. His muscles seemed to relax. Casually, confidently, he stepped up to Chalice and reached out to dig his fingers into her cheek and chin, as if he might tear off her face as he would a mask. Chalice gasped in pain but did not struggle. When Verge wrenched at her, sent her toppling to the floor, she rolled but did not rise again, looking up from a face streaked with shallow cuts. "The Emperor," Verge said, flicking his hand as if he trailed it through mud, "has no need of a woman like you. And in your defeat, I have proven myself worthy of a place alongside Vader." Chalice looked small and crumpled on the floor. Tabor did not pity her.
"If you say so."
Her voice was now rough and cracking. With one hand, she reached into one of the pockets of her pants and withdrew a small, flat device with a single button.
"Stop her!"
Tabor wanted to shout, but it was too late. He saw her thumb flex, heard the tiniest of clicks. For an instant, nothing happened. Then the shuttle seemed to come ablaze with a blinding aura of blue-white light. Electrical arcs leapt over its surface, and the shuttle bay echoed with the sounds of sparks and current. Popping noises emanated from control panels around the hangar as arcs of lightning touched tractor beam generators and docking clamps. A noxious smell of melted metal and plastoid caused Tabor to gag and shield his nose with his sleeve. When the light faded, spots of green and red floated across Tabor's eyes, and he blinked harshly to clear them. Somehow, words came to him as his stunned, aging brain realized what had occurred.
"An ion bomb," he murmured.
The deck shuddered beneath him, and the hull of the Herald seemed to groan.
"About 20 of them,"
Chalice said.
She was on her hands and knees, slowly climbing to her feet. Her voice was suddenly desiccated.
"Everything Twilight had left."
The deck shuddered again. Verge glanced about, legs gently bowed for balance and lips twisted into a sneer.
"This is an Imperial Star Destroyer. All vital equipment is shielded. Even 20 bombs will do nothing."
But that wasn't true. Tabor shook his head, trying to organize his thoughts. Why wasn't it true? Think, Tabor.
"We're in atmosphere," he said, embarrassed at his own urgent tone. "We need full power to stay aloft. Any disruption at all."
Star Destroyers were extraordinary vessels, capable of raising mountains and carrying armies. But their mass was measured in millions upon millions of tons, and their energy requirements were vast. He made an effort to compose himself to speak in a manner befitting an Imperial captain.
"We must withdraw immediately," he said.
He tapped his comlink.
"Transfer all weapons and auxiliary power, anything we can spare, to the engines. Get us back in orbit."
In return, he heard only Chalice's guttural laughter.
"Of course."
The Herald's systems were largely shielded, but his comlink had been disabled, along with anything in the hangar more complex than a light fixture. He turned to the guards, ordered the message carried to the bridge. They ran together to the hangar door, which did not open.
Tabor spat a curse.
The guards set to removing the control panel and searching for the override. Verge stood unmoved, staring at Chalice, as if the ion blast had broken him too.
"Why did you do this?"
Tabor wanted to shout at Chalice.
What do you gain aside from bloodshed?
Did she really mean to give her life for the rebel cause?
Still think you've won the Emperor's favor?
Chalice asked, eyes locked with Verge's.
You still belong to me,
Verge said, though he sounded uncertain.
And in capturing me, you've put one of Sallust's most important assets in the hands of the Rebellion.
She shook her head slowly.
Not in a calculated trade either, but in a bungled act of ego and idiocy.
The deck lurched, sending Tabor hard onto his knees. A sharp pain burst up his legs, and he wondered how much damage he'd done to his bones. He glanced to the guards who were sprawled on the ground with the door only open a crack, to Chalice, who was kneeling once again. Only Verge had retained his balance. As klaxons began to sound outside the bay, he lunged forward, grasping Chalice by the chin and striking her across the face. Again she did not struggle, only turning to ease the pain of the blows as they came in a swift repeating blur. When Verge, blood speckling his knuckles and his face, his eyes wide as a rabid animal's, paused to catch his breath, the governor laughed again.
I've seen Vader,
she said, a red smile on her lips.
Next to him, you really are pathetic.
Verge froze with one hand curled like a claw above Chalice's eyes.
We're through,
one of the guards called. The other was attempting to squeeze into the narrow gap they'd created between door and frame.
Stop,
Verge said, his voice almost gentle. We will not withdraw from the battle. Tabor was too confused to protest. Verge kept speaking.
The Emperor will not forgive this failure, nor should he. Have the bridge direct all firepower at the rebel army. Destroy the processing facility if you must. But we will not allow Salas to fall.
Implications crept over Tabor much too slowly.
Prelate!
He began sharply, scolding. He forced himself to moderate his tone, but he could hear his own strain.
Sallust will not be lost. We can fight the battle another day. To sacrifice our men and the men on the ground.
The Herald had a crew of thousands. They had given everything to Verge, but this was too much. This was madness.
Why did you do this?
Do not question my orders, Captain,
Verge said. His voice remained childishly gentle.
We have all failed, and we are all responsible. We will fly this vessel into the mountain before we suffer another defeat.
Then, Chalice struck Verge while his head was turned, and he could argue no more. The two grappled fiercely, the boy in his prime against the governor twice his age. Yet sheer savagery offered her an edge Verge could not easily overcome. Tabor called to the prelate, but his voice was lost in the struggle and the klaxons. The guards stood where they were, unsure of what to do. But they were good men, dutiful. In a moment, they'd accept their prelate's orders and head for the bridge. Tabor cursed and drew his sidearm, leveled it at the fighting pair. His pistol was a Marison B-22. Mechanically activated. It might still be capable of firing after the ion blast. If he could end the fight, he might be able to talk sense into the prelate, and the Herald might yet escape. His hands were trembling as he squinted, tried to acquire his target. In the back of his mind, he considered what he could say to sway Verge, what argument he could make to demonstrate that the deaths of so many good men were unnecessary. He searched his memory, sifted through conversations with the boy over breakfast and while observing interrogations. He tried to fit the pieces of Verge's crazed philosophy together to find something in his vision of the Empire that Tabor could use. He imagined the crew of the Herald dying for the boy's passion. He pulled the trigger. The holdout pistol's muzzle flashed red. The combatants separated.
and Verged looked at Tabor with wide, mystified eyes, the look of a hound cruelly struck by its master, before falling to the ground. Flames licked at the hole in his chest.
"Tell the bridge to pull out. All power to the engines," Tabor said.
He heard the guards moving, scraping through the crack in the doorway. They were good men. He could count on them. Chalice's face was a mask of blood. He aimed the pistol at her breast. She was smiling.
"Why did you do this? Out of spite? Out of rebel loyalty?"
"Captain Citeron," she said, "Tabor."
"You are responsible here," Tabor said. "Not the boy whose madness was given to him, not chosen."
Dead, Verge no longer seemed threatening or unpredictable. He was a victim of circumstance, a brilliant mind, and an eager patriot. Verge had believed he was doing Tabor a kindness, bringing the old captain out of retirement. Tabor found his vision blurring. He prepared to fire.
"One question first," Chayla said.
"One question only,"
Tabor snarled. She shrugged, as if she'd expected that answer.
"Tell me," she said, "if I shot the prelate while you and your guards were trapped outside, how could I then shoot myself in the chest with my own pistol?"
Tabor stared at Chalus, as if she'd gone mad.
Chapter 39.
Planet Salast, Day 3 of the Siege of Inusutur.
When the Star Destroyer withdrew above the clouds, Twilight Company cheered over the sounds of explosions and blaster fire. Why it happened, no one could guess. The odds that a pilotless promise had defeated the Herald seemed nil, and no weapons fire streamed skyward from Pinyumba to suggest Nian Nunba's cell had captured the city defenses. But whatever the reason, it was a welcome gift and seemed to inspire the rebel troops as much as it demoralized the Imperial infantry. Yet the fighting at the gates of the processing facility dragged on, would have to drag on, Namir knew, until the Imperial army had been reduced to chaff. He'd lashed the two forces together, bound them in chains of lava, and one would be completely destroyed before the day was over. Namir fired his rifle until his fingers cramped, until his hips grew sore from crouching. As afternoon approached evening, he fell back with the squads into the facility depths. Onto the mouth of the entryway was a distant spot of daylight. The metal floor that stretched before the company was littered with debris from broken machines once used as barricades, with the bodies of stormtroopers and Twilight soldiers, with broken guns and discarded power packs and cracked helmets. And still the foe came. Sometimes by tens and twenties, sometimes in smaller teams, augmented by portable cannon fire and repulsor vehicles. Namir saw friends and comrades rent by blaster bolts, immolated by flamers, pierced by shrapnel. A stormtrooper drew a line of blood across his chest with a vibroblade. Someone else wrestled the trooper away, gave Namir the chance to bind his shallow wound and return to the fight. He had no idea who'd saved his life. Occasionally, a voice would speak in his ear through his link, reporting on how the fight proceeded at the other facility gates. Namir sent reinforcements where they were needed, called for aid when the fighters at his entrance were hard-pressed. But for the most part, the tactics both sides employed were simple. The time to be clever had ended on the mountainside. Once during a lull between attacks, Namir saw a body move beside him and moan. In a haze of exhaustion, he didn't realize the wounded woman was an Imperial until after he had passed her his canteen. She crawled away, only to be shot by a Twilight sniper. But as evening turned to night, the lulls between attacks became steadily longer. Nearly an hour passed after one furious assault, and Namir and the others glanced uncertainly at one another, unwilling to leave their posts and afraid to break the spell.
They no longer heard distant shouts or the rumbling of explosions. The gateway to the mountain was dark. In the silence of the battlefront, the truth eventually became obvious. Twilight Company had won.
Chapter 40.
Planet Sunlust. 2 days after the siege of Inusutor.
Baron Iendi should not have been alive. Being transferred from the garrison's emergency ward to the civilian clinic for recuperation was the only thing that had saved her. She'd held the medics at gunpoint throughout the day while hunching forward on a chair, allowing them to treat the handful of stormtroopers and civilians who'd trickled in, but ensuring they couldn't join the uprising. Too exhausted and pained to hold back, she'd wept when news arrived that the garrison had been flooded by lava. If she'd had the strength, she might have joined the security forces in the street. As it was, she could only watch from the sidelines and listen to the raucous celebrations that told her Pinyumba had been captured. Captured by the same people she'd been trying to protect and clothe and feed. She didn't understand. When the time came, she surrendered to the rebels without a fight. Now, 2 days after the fighting had ended, she was officially a prisoner of the Rebel Alliance. Due to the number of captives taken during the uprising, everyone from Imperial administrators to security force members to civilian overseers of Binyumba's industrial enterprises, she'd been permitted to serve in a limited work release capacity with the supervision of an authorized volunteer. Unofficially, she was working at her uncle's cantina. The cantina itself had become a refuge in the aftermath of the crisis. When Vara's uncle had been released from holding, he'd immediately begun using it as a distribution point for donated supplies. While some of Pinyumba's residents were untouched by the revolution, others had seen their housing blocks burned and their possessions confiscated. They needed help that other residents were glad to give. And as volunteers flocked to the cantina, it also became a place to exchange information about Pinyumba's rebuilding, to organize meetings and discussions on how the city would run without the Empire. It was busy at all hours, and therefore Vara was busy too. She tracked goods as they came in and out, repaired broken machines, passed along messages. She served drinks. Her uncle watched her closely, though he tried not to show it. She could have sabotaged his operation, but what was the point? She felt the eyes of the cantina regulars on her as she carried a tray to a table occupied by mineral processing workers. The facility wouldn't be back online for a week or more, so the old men had time to spare.
"I know who you are,"
one of the workers said. She recognized the speaker, a withered Celestin with drooping ears and jowls. He'd been the first to speak openly against the Emperor in her presence months earlier. The others had been terrified. She hadn't reported him. He reached out with a wrinkled hand and gripped her wrist gently. She wanted to slap him away, but she made herself smile. She couldn't afford to make trouble. "I'm not trying to hide it," she said, low and sharp. The old Celestin patted her wrist twice and let go.
"We all pick sides," he said. "No shame in picking the wrong one."
Vara stared at the Celestin in surprise. Then she left the tray on the table and walked away. Not everyone was pleased that Pinyumba had joined the rebellion. She knew how to interpret disquieted murmurs, weary sighs that held a subtext of displeasure. Instability was the watchword among Celestins who feared what the rebellion might do to their home. They didn't dare speak their defiance openly, neither did she. But she wanted to turn back to the old man and ask for all of them, "Who says I picked the wrong side?" She loved her uncle and she loved Pinyumba. But her colleagues were dead. She wore a bandage over her stomach and couldn't move faster than a hobble anymore. If the Empire came back, she had every intention of rejoining the Stormtrooper Legions. And yet,
The very thought of taking up a rifle against the people in her cantina made her tremble. Drops of water and tea and ale spilled down the sides of the glasses she carried to and from the bar. She hoped the peace lasted a little while.
Chapter 41.
Planet Samast. 3 days after the siege of Inusutor.
Over a third of the company was dead. Another 100 Twilight members, give or take, were hurt badly enough to be off the active duty roster. Namir was certain some would never return to Twilight. Others would retire from combat roles and join the decimated support staff. There had been no non-combatants in the siege, and Twilight Company was now as short on medics and engineers as it was on soldiers. Even the loss of domestic labor droids aboard the Thunderstrike left the company wanting chefs and translators and mechanics. Gadrin was among the wounded. He'd lost an arm to a grenade during the final hours of the conflict.
"We're built sturdier than humans, with limbs to spare,"
he declared more than once in the days after, in the same tone every time, as if it was a mantra instead of a joke. Despite the injury, despite Von Geis's disapproval, he spent his mornings with the Thunderstrike salvage crew, searching the wreckage for supplies and equipment and the personal effects of friends. Roach was among the dead. Gadrin had told Namir the story of her heroic final charge.
"She dived into the flood of combatants, red hair flying like a banner, silent and determined. A speeder bike laden with explosives raced toward us without a pilot. She vaulted over stormtroopers, stung by bolt after bolt, but never hit full force until she had a clear shot at the speeder. Then everything flashed in fire, and she died our savior."
"Is any of that true?" Namir had asked.
"There are no certainties in battle,"
Gadrin had said, his voice low and haunted. No one else Namir spoke to had seen Roach fall. He let Gadrin tell the story the way he wanted. He didn't think Roach would mind. He did wonder why she'd chosen that name. He wished he'd known her better. He said as much to Brand as they picked their way along the upper slope of the mountain. Officially, they were checking for anything dangerous that might impact workers traveling from Pinyumba to the processing facility. Unexploded ordnance or dormant mines, though neither was especially suited to the job.
"Not much to do about it now," Brand said.
Namir started to snap at her, but she kept talking.
"Roach was okay. Didn't need you. You did your part."
Namir nodded and knelt to the rocks, picked up a dagger of slate and tossed it down the slope.
"I get that. But the only reason I'm still here, I don't want to fight alongside strangers," he thought.
What was the point of being worthy of his friends if they all slipped away? But he couldn't bring himself to say it. Brand didn't seem to hear him anyway. They continued their descent, occasionally passing a mortar-pounded crater or the body of a soldier that had been picked apart by ash angels.
"I miss them too," Brand said after a while.
It sounded like a denunciation, as if she expected better of herself. She stopped walking and Namir drew close to her side. They stood in silence until Brand spoke again.
"Why do I always survive?"
He studied her, found that her mask was no more revealing than her face.
"I don't know. Some of us just do, I guess."
It was an unsatisfying answer. All he could do was commiserate.
"I survive." "You're still young. Practically Roach's age."
"I've been doing this longer than most of us, I know. But it's not the same." She started to walk again, but her strides were slow and measured.
"I need you, you know," Namir called. "We're still here because of you."
Because of things she'd said. He indicated the mountain with a gesture of his chin. His tone was somber. It was a statement, not a question or a plea.
"Not me. Because of Howl.
Bran said. Then she turned to him, locked eyes as well as she could with her mask on.
We did good, she said. I'm not going anywhere.
Pinyamba was free, and its imperial masters had fled, surrendered, or defected. The city's not insubstantial defenses were under civilian control, guaranteeing at least a brief stay of execution. Pirate broadcasts and intercepted imperial signals indicated that other insurrections had begun across the planet. Those too would delay the Empire's inevitable counterattack. Namir knew all this because Nia Nunba's rebel cell had harangued him into joining daily meetings of the city's interim government. The meetings were torment, full of debate about who was to administer what water treatment system and whether the cavern's artificial night should be shortened during reconstruction. Namir's only role was to speak up when military concerns arose and to occasionally volunteer his troops for menial tasks. Namir was relieved, at least, that neither he nor the other Twilight soldiers who spent time in Pinyamba were celebrated as heroes. The Celestines were too busy and too pragmatic for that, and had suffered enough of their own losses. Yet now and then a Celestine would approach and murmur quiet thanks, or an old human woman would press a gift of flowers or fruit or etched metal into his hands.
Salast will change,
Nia Nunba told him at the end of each meeting. Corjentane translated it the first time. The others Namir figured out for himself. After the meetings, Namir would walk through the streets of Pinyamba, streets that had been empty only a few days before and were now packed with people, and absorb the sights of the weird and wondrous cavern. He strolled along the banks of the turquoise streams and ran his fingers through the yellow dust that coated the rocks. Without his people around, he had no need to feel embarrassed. Yet there was no escaping his responsibilities. Along with the meetings in Pinyamba, Namir faced the burden of pre-dawn conferences with the remnants of Twilight Company's leadership. The interim government wants us around for 2 more weeks at least, he told them on the 4th day after the siege. Once they feel secure, we'll get out of the way. Ease the threat, make the Empire a little less eager to reduce this area to slag. Not a lot of time, I know, but it should be enough to either get the Thunderstrike working or find alternative transport. Let's stick with the second option, Vifra muttered. Namir winced. The dig team's efforts to unleash the mountain's lava had left her with only a handful of engineers.
What about after? Carver asked.
You mean what about Kuat? Namir replied, as casually as he could. Carver nodded. Hober averted his eyes. Bongai stared intently at Namir. The others watched and waited. Not an option anymore, Namir said, for all the obvious reasons.
Then what?
Carver began. Namir interrupted him. We've got plenty of time. Start thinking.
If we're lucky, maybe we'll get new orders. If not, we'll find something that works.
There would be grumbling among both the senior staff and the rank and file. That didn't concern Namir. There was always grumbling, and he'd done his share when Howl had been in charge. But taking into account everything lost in the prior months, Twilight had become a shadow of its former self. So many dead, so many wounded, so much equipment destroyed and resources expended. Optimistically, the company was at 1/3 strength. For the moment, its ambitions needed tempering. Namir listened to updates on salvage operations, on the recuperation of the wounded, and on the repairs of the Apylanus Promise. The gunship had escaped its battle with the Herald, with its laser batteries drained and its deflectors overheated, but its hull stunningly intact. As the meeting drew to a close and the attendees filed out of the facility conference room, Namir caught Gadrin by the shoulder and drew him aside. You going back to the Thunderstrike? Namir asked.
That was my intent. It seems where I can be the most use.
He might as well have said my squad is gone. Except Brand, but Brand didn't take orders. I've got another use for you, Namir said. You're good with civilians. Wanna be my liaison to Pinyamba? Gadran smiled slowly, sadly, as he looked down on Namir.
That is not necessary,
he said. It's for my sanity. I'm doing twice the work I was before, and I have no one to gripe to. You know this company as well as anyone. All of which was true. His desire to share the burden was genuine, as was his desire to keep Gadran close for both their sakes. Gadran closed his eyes and flexed three sets of meaty fingers. A low hum came from his throat, deep enough that Namir seemed to feel it in his bones.
Very well. For now. But I cannot be your lieutenant or... her.
Namir smirked and shook his head. Fine. But you couldn't do a worse job than she did. He said it because he hoped to win over Gadran and because she was an easy target. It was, however, a lie. For all Chalice's faults, she had done well by Twilight Company. The mistakes had been Namir's. Namir had not heard any news of the governor since Brand had reported her flight down the mountain. He suspected she was alive, though it was only a hunch. Her body might have been incinerated by the lava or lost to scavenging ash angels. Either way, she was no longer his responsibility. Even Howl, he suspected, would have conceded that point. For reasons he couldn't explain, however, Namir found himself often looking to the bronze bust in his office, studying the stern face and wondering about the hands that shaped it. He was eyeing the statue 5 days after the siege when a voice announced through his comm, "Captain, there's a recorded message coming in for you. Source unknown. Rebel encryption codes." Namir frowned. "Specifically for me?" "Yes, sir. By name." That seemed unusual for a message from Alliance High Command. Had anyone even told the rebel leaders Howl was dead? But it was a mystery easily solved. "Send it over," Namir said. The hollow display on his terminal flickered to life. Azure static coalesced into a once youthful face, invaded by the gentle lines of age. The woman lacked the darkness under her eyes Namir had grown familiar with, though her hair seemed grayer than ever, and long, half-healed scratches marked her cheeks and chin.
"Sergeant,"
the recording of Ivari Chalice said.
"I hear you won on Salast. So I'm assuming you're still alive. Congratulations."
Namir realized his shoulders had tensed and forced them to relax. Chalice's voice was rusty, but it wasn't only the usual hoarseness he heard. Her accent had changed. And for the third time since they'd met, it was neither entirely foreign nor entirely familiar. Namir had come to think of it as her natural inflection, native to whatever world, like Crucible, she'd once come from. But she spoke with the casual haughtiness that was her manner around men and women she disdained.
"As for me, I'm very far from Salast, and I won't be returning to Twilight Company or the Rebellion. We never really were a good match, even when our goals looked similar. You made that clear to me in the end. I thought I owed it to you to say so in person."
Her lips twisted into a wry smile.
"Or as close as I can get under the circumstances. Where I'm going next shouldn't and won't concern you. It's best that our paths don't cross again."
For several seconds, the message continued in silence. Chalice's eyes flickered to one side, then back to the recorder. When she spoke again, her matter-of-fact tone was replaced by something colder.
"Since I left Hadoral Prime to join your company, I've been humbled. I've been humiliated. It's not the first time, and I accept that as the price of survival. But you, Hazram Namir, I thought we recognized something in each other. I thought we had a kinship. Instead, you judged me the same way the Empire did. You thought my talent was for making promises instead of keeping them.
She seemed to tremble for a moment. Then she stilled herself and went on.
I could have won at Kuat. I could have hurt the Empire. But you didn't trust me.
Then the hologram flashed into non-existence, and Namir was left alone.
Chapter 42.
Numacera Sector. 5 days after the siege of Inusutur.
For the first time in as long as she could remember, Ivari Chalas, former governor of Hedoral Prime and emissary to the Imperial Ruling Council, was free to do as she pleased. The hardest part about escaping Sallust had been swaying Captain Cyteron. The man had been surprisingly slow to permit Ivari to take the blame for Prelate Verger's murder, even slower to accept that Ivari's disappearance, not her death, which would leave contravening evidence, was the best means to erase all doubt as to her responsibility. Surely no one would be surprised by her traitorous flight from the scene of her ghastly crime. The old man loathed her. He doubtless still wanted her dead. But his priorities were his crew and his desire to return to the comforts of his academy, perhaps not in that order. And the more incompetent Verge appeared, the more attention would be diverted from Cyteron and the Herald to Ivari herself. She had won the blind eye she needed to seize a fresh shuttle and depart, all using an argument barely plausible enough to pass muster. Here's to the malleable brains of guilt-ridden old men, she thought, and raised her canteen to the million stars beyond the cockpit of her ship. She thought of her last drink, her last real drink, back in Captain Ivan's quarters, after the campaign on Mardona III. She thought of the company she'd kept, and her mood curdled. She could have told Namir in her message that she'd saved him and his whole company by forcing the Herald out of Sallust's atmosphere. But what difference would it make? Let him think of her as he would. She owed him a farewell and nothing else. Now she was done with Twilight Company. She was done thinking about Twilight Company. She'd invested too much effort and emotion into those people and received only pain in return. She felt a tingling in her throat, the familiar start of a coughing fit. She made her body rigid, hissed a breath through her teeth, and forced it down. The rebels were no longer looking over her shoulder, terrified she might betray them. The Empire was no longer sending spies and political officers to keep her prisoner in her own home. Since leaving Sallust, she'd spent the last handful of days ensuring her security and anonymity, trading the Herald shuttle for a civilian starcutter, draining the off-world financial account she'd set up years before, doing everything she should have done months earlier on Hedoral Prime before being forced to turn to the Rebellion for aid. She had neither authority nor wealth, but she was free. She had all the tools she needed to build a new life. She just needed to decide where to go next. She had told Namir once that all she really wanted was time to sculpt, reasonable comforts, and a measure of respect. Maybe that was still true. She could find herself a forgotten little world at the edge of known space, something like her own home world, where she could afford a patch of land and provincial luxuries. She could pay children with treats to fetch her clay and spend her days relearning her craft. She had been a good artist once, before Count Vidian had taken her from the Colonial Academy and redirected her talent for visualization. She could be a good artist again, hidden on a planet beneath anyone's notice while the rest of the galaxy fought and burned and fell into chaos. What was the name of Namir's homeworld? She could sell a few technological trinkets there and be set for decades. Crucible! Ivari tapped at the ship's console and began searching the Navicomputer for coordinates.
As she did, she sipped her water again, imagined dampening a lump of clay and shaping it beneath her fingers. With enough time, she could fill her own gallery. A gallery no one would ever bother to come see. There were many reasons people might seek her out. Her schematic of the Empire's logistics, the secrets of Alliance High Command, but a viewing of her artwork was not among them. She smiled bitterly at the irony. She possessed information men would sacrifice armies to obtain, yet she was choosing to retire to a galactic backwater. There were other options open to her. She could find buyers for her secrets despite the risk. She could play all sides in the Civil War. Not just the Rebel Alliance and the Empire, but the Crimora, on aligned worlds. She could become a power broker, operating in the shadows but grudgingly respected by those who knew her name. Respected by the self-declared rulers of the galaxy at last. It was tempting. Of course it was tempting. It was past time her detractors understood what she was capable of. She drummed her fingers on the console, drew in a long breath, and winced as the air touched the scars inside her throat. She had decisions to make, a new life to build. But there was no rush.
Chapter 43.
Planet Sallust. 5 days after the siege of Inusutor.
Much to his surprise, Namir felt an emptiness after viewing Chalice's final message. It was the same sort of emptiness he had felt years before, after learning of his father's death. He was mourning, to be certain, but he wasn't sure what precisely he mourned. Chalice had accused him of failing to put his trust in her. There might have been some truth to that, but true or not, the outcome would have been the same. He was responsible now for Twilight Company. Not just its people or their goals, but the ideals Howl had set forth. The ideals that meant victory and sacrifice if the fight was worth fighting. The worthy fight had been on Sallust, not Kuat. Choosing one over the other hadn't been a betrayal of Chalice. If she wouldn't see that, the fault was hers. Still, there was no one in the company who would understand why he would miss her. He kept the message to himself. That afternoon, he walked among the wounded in the medbay, among the salvage crews still picking at the wreckage of the Thunderstrike, among the mountain patrols lugging plexes in case an Imperial airspeeder dared to approach. He tried to take in the mood, interpret his soldiers' complex mix of pride and uncertainty and frustration and sorrow. He felt no regret over his most recent choices, and he sensed no anger directed toward him. That was something, at least. He allowed himself to think about the dead only briefly. He'd asked Hober to prepare a funeral for that night. Something using the resources on hand. The Pinyumba interim leadership had offered the assistance of Celestine cryptmasters and formal burial space in the caverns. But Namir had declined the offer. Twilight took care of its own, even after death. As it turned out, the service took place in Pinyumba anyway, broadcast to the processing facility for those unable to attend. Instead of a vehicle charging station, Hober drained the last sparks of exhausted blaster packs into an array of emergency generators he'd somehow acquired from the Celestines.
"We'll have a new ship sooner or later," he told Namir. "It'll need emergency power, and I'll make damn sure these get used."
The funeral went on almost 4 hours. Somehow, Hober and Von Geis had found a speaker for every dead soldier, no matter if all his teammates had fallen. Namir stepped up 3 times for recruits he'd trained over the years. Gadrin delivered 4 eulogies, including Roach's.
"Child of an age of empire and war, never broken, and fiercer than us all."
Even Brand spoke out for an engineer and one of the ensigns from the Thunderstrike's bridge crew.
The droids, too, received send-offs, as if they had been as alive as the rest of the company. Namir didn't entirely understand, but it seemed to comfort the others. Even the Thunderstrike received a moment of honor as Hober drained one of its laser cannon plasma cells.
"Ugly girl and meaner than sin," Commander Tona called, and the assembled soldiers cheered.
Afterward, a few dozen attendees filtered into a Pinyumba cantina that had volunteered to host a reception. Gadarin, Brand, Twitch, and Tona quickly located a deck of cards and began a game. Namir sat nearby, observing the hands and calling out corrections over his shoulder as Carver sat at the bar, recounting the battle on Force Aged.
"The cards are lucky tonight," Tona declared after a competitive round. "You should join us, Captain."
"I'm busy," Namir said, and jutted a thumb back at Carver. Carver shouted something obscene. "Don't let me slow you down." "You'll never get him to join," Brand said with a smirk. She'd been drinking just enough to loosen her lips. Twitch snickered. Tona looked to Gadarin, who shrugged gently.
"He thinks we do not know," Gadarin said.
"Know what?" Tona asked.
Gadarin glanced sidelong at Namir, who scowled at him.
"I have spoken out of turn. The captain's choices are his own."
Brand jumped in.
"No Sabacc games where he grew up," she said. "He can't admit he doesn't know how to play."
"I know how to play," Namir snapped. Twitch burst out laughing. Gadarin looked contrite. Brand just leaned back in her chair and played a hand that won her the pot. It wasn't a bad night. When most of the others had returned to the processing facility or to lodgings offered by the Celestines, Namir walked with Gadarin through the quiet streets of Pinyumba. "I want to hold an open recruit," Namir said. "Noon tomorrow, if the Pinyumba Council approves." Gadarin nodded slowly.
"You mean to continue Howl's tradition? You have had concerns in the past."
"Still do," Namir said. "But Howl knew what he was doing. If this is how we fight, then that's how we endure." He spoke with certainty. He'd already chosen the path. This was only the next step. The citizens of Pinyumba trickled slowly into the market after the announcement went out. Some only came to question the Twilight recruiters before walking away. Others watched fearfully from a distance. But soon the line grew long, filled with a motley assortment of young and old, pampered and desperate. Namir recognized a few of the locals from his rounds with Nia Nunban the night before the battle. He saw a withered Celestine offer his expertise as a mechanic. An eager human youth, who'd never fired a blaster, volunteered to take up the fight against the Empire. The open recruit continued into the evening and night. What the coming weeks would bring for Sallust and for Twilight remained in doubt, and the end of the war was no longer even the distant dream it had been on Hoth. Yet one thing was absolutely certain. Twilight Company lived on. This is Jonathan Davis. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Star Wars Battlefront, Twilight Company, by Alexander Freed. This program was directed by Kevin Thompson. Executive producer, Aaron Blank. Star Wars Battlefront, Twilight Company, is a production of Lucasfilm Limited and registered or trademarked where indicated. Copyright 2015. All rights reserved. Used under authorization. Music composed by John Williams. Music publishing by Warner Tamerlane Publishing Corporation and Bantha Music. Music master production, copyright 2007, Lucasfilm Limited. This has been a Penguin Random House audio presentation. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.